From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Monday morning, Russia's war against Ukraine continues unabated. Over the weekend, there were reports of artillery damaging apartment buildings in Kyiv and airstrikes hitting a military base that's dangerously close to the Polish border. All that has prompted a massive wave of refugees to flee the fighting, an estimated 2.8 million people so far, though that number is expected to continue growing. At a rally in Chicago over the weekend, Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin reflected on that aspect of the crisis.
Can you imagine for a moment in your own life, with your wife, with your child, saying goodbye at that train station, hoping and praying that you'll get on that train, and hoping and praying that you'll see your husband again alive someday? That is the reality of life in Ukraine. We know it because we see it in real time. It breaks your heart.
We're scheduled to speak with Durbin on the show tomorrow. But today, two Illinois perspectives on Ukraine. Among the 2.8 million refugees are the daughter and granddaughter of Marina Teplova, a doctoral candidate at Illinois State University. We'll hear about their harrowing journey on a blacked-out night train packed well beyond capacity with women and children. That's later this hour. But first, Julian Haida spent most of his life in Illinois. He earned 2 degrees from DePaul University and spent several years as a producer on Worldview, a public affairs program on the Chicago public radio station WBEZ. He also worked for a short time as a producer here on the 21st. Then, last fall, he decided to pursue a different calling, enrolling at a seminary in Kyiv. Now the war has prompted him to return to journalism, and he's working with an NPR team as a freelance producer, fixer, reporter, and translator. I spoke with Julian on Friday. Julian Haida, welcome to the 21st show. Thank you for being on with us.
Great to be with you, Brian.
So I want to just begin by asking, where are you? What's it like in the part of Ukraine where you are now?
I am in Lviv, which is a city in the far west of Ukraine. It's a pretty big city, about 700,000 people, although that number has swelled by about another 200,000 with refugees. It is pretty far from where the conflict is happening on the ground, but as we've seen in recent days, airstrikes have also reached hundreds of miles into western Ukraine, into some cities that are less than 100 miles from where I am right now. So that is rather concerning. Of course, that might change. This is a pretty interesting city when there isn't a lot of war going on in the country. One of the reasons for that is the architecture, the nightlife. It's a very fun town. Before the war, you could come here for some great dancing, some great beer. You would have live musicians playing on every street corner. But now what you have is everybody being kind of beat down. It's a very quiet city, uncannily so. In the decade plus I've been coming regularly to this city, this is the first time I have heard total silence on the street. Just a few days ago, I was with my colleague here in Lviv, Lauren Freyer, who's reporting from Western Ukraine. And we went to a funeral, and as the coffins were being brought outside, the snow started falling down, and it was just surreal. There were 5 coffins coming out of the church, and the street was just in silence. And then there were trumpets, bugles playing a kind of a salute for these soldiers that had fallen just mere days earlier.
Yeah, and this is, as you said, a bustling city. You would not expect silence in a place like this. And for people who don't maybe have a map of Ukraine in front of them, Lviv is what, about 340 miles west of Kyiv on the highways? The mapping software tells me it'd be about a 7-hour drive to a 9-hour drive, depending on the route you took. How is the city handling an influx of 200,000 additional people?
Well, the mayor of Lviv just a few days ago had a press conference where he talked about the dire need to invite humanitarian organizations into the city. There's a lot of humanitarian work that's being done at the borders as refugees leave the country. That's now over 2 million refugees. But there's also the people who don't want to leave Ukraine but want to be in a safe city. Lviv so far has avoided many of the airstrikes that have attacked many of the other cities in Western Ukraine and all across Ukraine. And so they feel safe here, but with the influx of people and with the difficulties at the border, it is rather difficult to get things like food, like medicine, just even a place to stay. Most people are now staying in theaters and schools. They have made room for 200,000 people. Many people have opened up their homes. They have adjusted bus schedules and train schedules to get people to where they need to go for resettlement purposes. So, you know, the city's managing, but it's difficult to tell how long it will hold out. Now, the agricultural minister has invited farmers to begin their harvest as if it were any other year, and a lot of people are kind of counting on Ukraine's very robust agricultural sector to feed the people who live here. That is, you know, still a few months out, and there's still some rather serious humanitarian concerns, especially as roads and points of access into the country are either being attacked and destroyed or are just overrun with refugees.
What is daily life like in Lviv? Are people going to grocery stores? Are they going to work if they work in non-critical fields? Is life going on, or is it everything sort of on hold, as one might imagine in a country at war?
You know, it's kind of difficult to figure out the way in which some people and some companies are responding to this crisis. Lots of restaurants and businesses are closed. Lots of people have left. And yet other things are operating as usual. You can visit any shop, and they'll mostly have what they had before. Some of them might have fewer things. Some of that might even be related to earlier supply chain issues. But other than the sadness that has permeated the city, not much has changed. A significant difference, though, is, like I was talking about the nightlife earlier, or that none of the bars are operating and none of the grocery stores sell any alcohol. So that might be the only difference. And of course, there's also a curfew at 10 p.m. So everybody goes to sleep very early. It gets very quiet at night. Nobody's allowed into the street. And so that's a pretty big difference as well.
You entered Ukraine on Tuesday from Poland. What was that like?
Well, the airspace over Ukraine has been unavailable to commercial aviation, and that's largely in part due to the Russian military sending missiles towards Ukraine, the Ukrainian military shooting down Russian airplanes, Russian missiles from the sky. So it is impossible to fly into Ukraine as one might have just a couple weeks ago. So I flew into Krakow in Poland, and I over land drove east towards Ukraine. I met up with some of my colleagues and we crossed together. Now, the border into Ukraine was rather easy to cross. There was a very long line of trucks, humanitarian assistance, private humanitarian assistance, nonprofits and NGOs who were trying to enter the country. I'm sure there are some journalists such as myself, but our car was, for a while, the only one in line. The way out of Ukraine was decidedly different. The line stretched for a little bit under 2 miles, a lot of people on foot. The line was also made up of buses that were just labeled children, that the children were on the bus. Now, men, all adult men, are not allowed to leave the country. And so you have a really disproportionate number of women and children leaving on their own and leaving on foot, again, with supply chain issues, gas, gasoline, making it very difficult. And of course, this country really relies on public transit as well. So when a lot of the infrastructure isn't working as intended for whatever reason, people have to walk. So the border was full of just pedestrians, and usually you're not allowed to cross at every border crossing on foot, but Poland has allowed that in recent weeks. And then you had, you know, just convenience stores, gas stations, things like that along the border where everything was bought out because people, as they're waiting for days and days to enter Poland, they are needing to eat something, they're needing to use the restroom. And so that has been a challenge to some of the businesses along the border as well. I didn't see any of this personally, but there were also reports of minorities in Ukraine, also foreign students and foreign workers who don't have Ukrainian citizenship having some trouble at the border. Fortunately, it would seem that a lot of foreign countries have lended their support to evacuating their citizens who had been living and staying in Ukraine amidst the Russian invasion.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Yulian Haida, who's a freelance journalist working with NPR in Ukraine. Previously, he worked as a producer on this show, on The 21st show, also for several years at Worldview, a program that was on WBEZ in Chicago. You were in Ukraine before the war started. Can you talk about what brought you there?
Yeah, I'm a legal resident of Ukraine, which is a bit of a change of gears from living in Illinois, as I have most of my life. I decided to take a little bit of a break from day-to-day journalism about a year ago. I was working in a nonprofit in a journalism capacity, but my family comes from a long line of priests, and so I decided, with all the suffering in the world, to heed the call to the priesthood. And so I joined the seminary last summer, and I moved to Ukraine. My wife joined me there. We have married priests in the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, which is what I belong to. There's a number of parishes across Illinois if anybody wants to visit. And I was studying in a seminary. Now, I don't see that big of a difference between journalism and the priesthood. It all has to do with listening. You listen to people, you listen to the most privileged or the most powerful, but you also listen to the most marginalized, and you try to find truth in listening. So I felt it was a natural fit to journalism, and I'll likely continue doing journalism. But after spending a little bit of time with my family in Illinois for Christmas, I realized, and I learned from the State Department, that it would be rather risky to return to Ukraine with the threat of war looming, or resumed war, since the war has been going on for 8 years, but an all-out war, an attack on the entire country. So I decided to stay for a bit at home in Illinois, and after my classes resumed, I flew to London, which was where I had some friends, and much easier to phone into online classes when you're 2 time zones behind instead of 8 time zones behind Ukraine. And it was while I was in London, while studying virtually with my friends in Ukraine, that I heard of the initial airstrikes and the breach of Ukraine's border. So very quickly, I got in touch with some of my close journalism friends, one of whom forwarded my name to NPR headquarters in Washington, and very quickly I ended up getting all trained up and sent here to help the team that has been doing fantastic work here for the last several weeks and even a couple months already.
How are your classmates from the seminary holding up?
Well, my seminary is in a suburb outside of Kyiv, and it's very close to some military installations. So the night of the first rocket strikes and airstrikes, you ended up, my classmates woke up from the sound of really heavy explosions. Some of those knocked some windows open, and many of them proceeded into the basement. It was the middle of the night. Many of them didn't think that such a thing could even happen. The neighboring town sustained a great deal of damage, and 12 civilians died. And they stayed there for much of the day. They tried to stack up some sandbags, make a bit of a makeshift bomb shelter. They did their morning prayers in the basement of the church there. And after a continued assault, they decided the safest thing for them to do would be to leave the town, leave the city in a convoy and drive west. It took them a couple of days, but many of them are in the parts of Ukraine, mostly in rural areas, because that's where it tends to be safer from air bombardment in western Ukraine. And there are lectures that happen about once a day, but nobody's in class, nobody's getting a grade. Everybody is involved somehow using their talents and responding to the situation as appropriately as they can. Of course, you know, we're a religious bunch, and so what that means is being nonviolent, being witnesses to truth, being present for people in their greatest time of need. So, you know, everybody, all of my classmates are doing that a little bit differently. They're all doing it based on how they know how to do it and with the guidance of their spiritual directors. But it is certainly a difficult time knowing that one was so close to such carnage and such death. Some of my classmates had family and have family near cities like Mariupol, which has quickly become a very large site of humanitarian concern, and they have tried their best to keep in touch with their families, and it, you know, this is affecting everybody. Nobody wants to see their neighbors or their family die, no less in a way that is so violent. And so you really see that in some of the people here.
Okay, we need to take a break. More to come from my conversation with former 21st Show producer Yulian Haida, who's currently freelancing with NPR in Ukraine. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're continuing my conversation with Yulian Haida. He spent most of his life in Illinois and was a radio producer, including for a short time on The 21st Show. Then, last year, he enrolled at a seminary in Kyiv. He decided to study remotely from London this semester, but after Russia invaded, he returned to journalism and is now freelancing with NPR. I spoke with him last Friday from the western Ukrainian city of Lviv. Last week on the program, we spoke with Ian Kelly, who is a former ambassador under the Obama administration of the Republic of Georgia, and had a long career in the State Department, an expert on Russia. And we were talking about the way this is often framed in the U.S. is a sort of a power conflict, right, between the West and Russia, and then, oh yeah, the Ukrainian people as well. And I realize, I'm sure that public opinion in Ukraine can be as divided as it is in other places, back here in America as well. But from the people you talk to, do you get a sense of the end game they're hoping for? The best case scenario they hope can come out of this?
Well, based on what I've been hearing here, and a lot of the people I've been talking to even for the last several weeks, months, and years, is that everybody here wants peace. They all have a different sense of how that peace will be achieved, but the overwhelming number of people that I've met here want to see Ukraine preserved in some sense. They want to see Ukraine continue to be sovereign, continue to be a place where the great experiment of liberal democracy can continue to flourish as an oasis in this part of the world in some ways. And so they are afraid to lose that, and they'll fight for it, and they've expressed that very clearly in whatever way they can. Of all ages, people of all ages are trying to do their part. And I hear what you said about, Ambassador Kelly, and I've talked to Ambassador Kelly in the past. You know, in a way, the way that this is being portrayed by Russia is for the advancement of their domestic geopolitical goals. Now, whatever that may be depends on who the audience is, who's paying attention. And so what is getting to a lot of people here in Ukraine is how much the conflict seems to do about Russian identity. The origins of the Russian state, according to Vladimir Putin, are in Ukraine, and therefore Ukraine cannot be separate from Russia. But it is a dive into history and culture that is causing people a lot of pain and disagreement, and few people in Ukraine can see why a disagreement about what belongs to who in the past should lead to a war that's taking so many lives in the present. So that's important to keep in mind, that this is justified in almost nationalist terms, that Russia is the only country that can address systemic problems in Ukraine, address an alleged Nazi presence in Ukraine that doesn't really exist on any sort of meaningful or systemic level. And that is how Russia is justifying this domestically and to the people of Ukraine. And of course, it's hurtful when you are told that your nation doesn't exist, your language doesn't exist, and that everything you believe in is part of an ideology that you do not believe in. And so I think people are in Ukraine and the Ukrainian diaspora in cities and countries around the world are trying to show that they are a distinct, discrete people, but also one that is tolerant and embraces democracy and peace.
Yeah, and just in point of fact, even though Moscow is saying that it's a country run by drug-addled Nazis, as we discussed last week on the show, the president is of Jewish descent, Russian-speaking, lost family members in the Holocaust. It's just mind-blowingly false.
Yeah, I mean, some of the early attacks even struck Holocaust sites in Ukraine. The Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine has rather unusually broken from the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia over the fact that even Russian Orthodox churches are getting destroyed.
What is the information environment like where you are now? We've talked about somewhat on the show about how, unless you are in an urban area with good internet access and a strong VPN, that what the people in Russia are hearing about this is pretty far from reality. Are people well informed where you are?
Well, it's hard to not be informed when air raid sirens go off.
Fair enough. I mean, you know, big picture, but I guess are lines of communication still functioning, I guess, maybe on a more granular level?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of grassroots communication, which, of course, poses some challenges, but the government has been really attentive to putting out statements, citing their sources. So, of course, as journalists, we have to verify a lot of those things, but the government has been rather transparent as far as we can understand with the information they're sharing. They're answering phone calls, they're allowing access for the most part, and there are thousands of journalists that are in Ukraine right now doing what they can to find out what's heads or tails. So, you know, that is still very much accessible. People are using platforms like Telegram with trusted sources. It's like a chat app that they could sign up for channels. The government has information there. You learn about air raids through that if you can't hear a siren. And you keep in touch with trusted government officials and trusted journalists who are verified, and you can get information from. So that is still pretty much accessible. But as you note, you know, I've read some Russian journalism over the last several days, and what you're reading there is just completely different. You won't even see references to civilian areas getting bombed or things like that. So it is a completely different understanding of what's going on.
What's next for you and the NPR team? Can you talk about any of the stories you're working on? I know you mentioned the Ukrainian Orthodox churches pushing back against their patriarch or bishop in Moscow. What else are you all following these days?
You know, audio is the kind of medium where you can get really, really intimate with people. So I'm not going to get into some of the details, but you're going to be hearing a lot of first-person stories from people who witnessed things that few people in the 21st century have witnessed and experienced, except for, you know, with the obvious exceptions of places like Syria or Afghanistan, and now Ukraine is on that list of places that have experienced this kind of suffering. So you will hear from people in their own words what they have experienced and what they're going through. And I think when it comes to understanding what's going on, hearing from people firsthand is invaluable.
Julian Haida, thank you for being there. Thank you for listening, and thank you for sharing your reporting with us. Stay safe.
Thanks so much, Brian. Thank you.